There's just a little part of that story that Lucretia didn't tell the children this morning. And that is that after she had forgotten her skirt that morning, her nickname for the rest of high school was Skirt. It stayed with you, didn't it? I know what it's like. I struggle every morning to get myself up and going too. I have, must confess though, I have never forgotten my skirt. I do try on weekday mornings to get myself together enough that before I have to leave the house, I turn on the television to catch the 7 o'clock news before I walk out the door. I happened to be able to do that on Wednesday, and when the newscaster came on, the first thing that she said was this: "Good morning on this day after Halloween." And it struck me so oddly that I haven't forgotten it. Good morning on this day after Halloween. That would be like getting up and turning on the news December 25th and having the newscaster say, "Good morning on this day after Christmas Eve." There was no recognition in her remark that Halloween is not the important thing. Halloween is the evening before the important thing. Just like Christmas Eve is the evening before the big celebration of Christmas Day, Halloween, the All Hallows Eve, is the evening before the great celebration of All Saints Day. But in our culture, we've let go of that. We've forgotten that. Halloween is itself not the important observance. All Saints Day is. It began early in our church's history. In those days of the Roman Empire, there was much persecution of those who were disciples of Jesus. And there were many who gave their lives rather than renounce their faith. They were called martyrs. Christian leaders began by designating a day for the commemoration of each martyr's life and death. But before long, there came to be more martyrs than there were days in the year. And so by the end of the 4th century, a single day had been designated to honor all those who had given their lives for their faith, just to be sure no one was not honored and no one was missed. A day was designated. And soon it came to include not only those who had been killed for their faith, but all of those who had died as faithful disciples of Jesus Christ. And it was called All Saints Day. And the designated date was November 1st. But since November 1st falls only occasionally on a Sunday, we observe the Sunday after November 1st as All Saints Sunday. And so here we are today, All Saints Sunday. We gather around the memory of those saints of our congregation who have died since our last All Saints Day. And it's a difficult day. It's a difficult day for a number of reasons. First, it's a difficult day because there are so many of them. 21 this year. I've been a pastor. This is my 30th year as a pastor, my 30th All Saints Day, and never have there been 21 candles on the altar. Never that many in a year. This has been a tough year for us. And in addition to these 21, there are many, many more. There have been two just this week. John Kurtz's father died this past week. His funeral was Wednesday. And as I was working on Friday morning, Tammy Ingram came into my office and told me that her mother had died. So in this past year, Tammy has lost her mother and Bill has lost his dad just in 1 year. So there are many more of you who know what All Saints Day is about. And this is a difficult day. We do indeed celebrate God's goodness and God's promises. We celebrate eternal life and salvation and heaven. But still, we come face to face again with death. and the memories of tragedy and illness and suffering and pain, the pain of sudden death, the difficulties of long illness, all of those flood into our minds again as we remember those dear to us, those whom we have loved, who have died. It's a difficult day for many of us this year, but it is also an important day, and it is essential that we do what we do on All Saints Day, because it helps us keep our focus and our conviction that our lives and the lives of those whom we love are indeed in God's keeping, sheltered in the everlasting arms of which we will sing fairly soon. Even the gospel for All Saints Day, even the story that I read for you a few minutes ago, confronts us with death's painful reality. And I want to call to your attention a particular exchange in that lesson that is troublesome for us. When Jesus came to Bethany, Mary approached him and she said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And then a bit later, some of those who had gathered around Mary and Martha at the time of their brother's death said, "Could not this one who restored sight to the blind man have prevented his friend from dying?" Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. I want to focus on that line for a few moments and caution you about it. Because Mary felt that way in the midst of her grief doesn't mean it was so. Nowhere, at that time or later, nowhere does Jesus embrace or confirm that remark. Nowhere does he indicate that he agrees with her statement or that it is true or accurate. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. Instead, Jesus was deeply moved to emotion himself because of his friend's death. He moved to the tomb, had the stone removed, and called Lazarus out, showing the glory of God's love by doing so. But nowhere does Jesus respond to Mary's statement, "If you had been here, my brother would not have died." And this is a problem for us, because even though Jesus did not embrace Mary's statement, we do. Somewhere within us, deep in us, there is a part of us that holds on to that idea and has a great deal of difficulty letting it go. We think that because Mary said it, it must be true. And if Jesus is present for us, and we are Jesus' friends, then we are shielded from the multitude of bad things that could happen. The things that happen to others but don't happen to us, because Jesus is here, we are protected. Jesus did not embrace Mary's statement, but we tend to do so. And it is not uncommon for us to think, or even to say, when misfortune strikes, that it is because we haven't been faithful enough, or prayerful enough, or good enough. Because if Jesus is here, if Jesus is with us, if we keep Jesus close, then we will not suffer from the tragedy of an early death. If Jesus is here and with us, we will not be the victims of crime. We will not suffer abuse. We will not fall prey to poverty. Illness will avoid us, and accidents won't happen to us. "If you had been here, my brother would not have died," Mary said. And somewhere within us, we think the same way. And we hold on to the same illusion. We are not as well equipped as we need to be to understand how God's Spirit moves within us and among us, and how God is at work in us and in our world. I have heard no one deal with this issue any better than Harold Kushner, who says this in one of his books. He says, "Laws of nature treat everyone alike. They don't make exceptions for good people or for useful people. If a man enters a house where someone has a contagious disease, he runs the risk of catching that disease. It doesn't matter why he's in the house. He may be a doctor. He may be a burglar. Disease germs can't tell the difference. If Lee Harvey Oswald fires a bullet at President John Kennedy, the laws of nature take over from the moment that bullet is fired. Neither the course of the bullet nor the seriousness of the wound will be affected by questions of whether or not President Kennedy was a good person, or whether the world would be better with him dead or alive. Laws of nature do not make exceptions for nice people. A bullet has no conscience. Neither does a malignant tumor. Neither does an automobile gone out of control. That is why good people get sick and get hurt as much as anyone. God does not reach down and interrupt the workings of the laws of nature to protect the righteous from harm. And how could we live in the world if God did that? Let us suppose, for example, that God was determined not to let any bad thing happen to a good and pious person. If Oswald shoots at the president, no matter how carefully he aims, God will make the bullet miss. If a wing falls off of Air Force One, God will make it land safely. Would that be a better world if certain people were immune from the laws of nature because God favored them while the rest of us had to fend for ourselves? Suppose I was one of those righteous people to whom God would not let anything bad happen. Because I am a faithful and charitable person with a young family spending my life helping people, God will not let any of those bad things happen to me. God would protect me. What would that mean? Would I be able to go out in my shirt sleeves in cold weather and not get sick? Because God would prevent the workings of nature from doing me harm? Could I cross the streets against the lights in heavy traffic and not be injured? Could I jump out of a high window when I was in too much of a hurry to wait for the elevator and not hurt myself? A world in which good people suffer from the same natural dangers that others do causes problems. But a world in which good people are immune to those laws would cause even more problems. Insurance companies refer to earthquakes, hurricanes, and other natural disasters as acts of God. I consider that a case of using God's name in vain. I don't believe that an earthquake that kills thousands of innocent victims without reason is an act of God. It is an act of nature. Nature is morally blind. Nature has no values. It just churns along, following its own rules and its own laws, not caring who gets in the way. But God is not morally blind. I could not worship God if I thought that God was morally blind. God stands for justice, for fairness, for truth, for compassion. For me, a hurricane is not an act of God. The act of God is the courage of people to rebuild their lives after the hurricane, and the rush of others to help them in whatever way that they can. And you're a part of that act of God going on right now. For just on Friday evening, a busload of us left, including Pastor Candy, left for New Orleans, and they are now there. The miracle of God, the act of God, helping others to rebuild in the ways that they can. It is much easier to take God seriously as the source of moral values if we don't hold God responsible for all the unfair things that happen in the world. Unfortunately, that's what Mary was doing in Bethany that day. She was trying to hold Jesus responsible for an unfortunate, tragic death of her brother. Jesus was not responsible for the death. Jesus is not responsible for the crime, the abuse, the pain, the storm. But Jesus is responsible for the resurrection. I don't know why my friend, my neighbor, so many of them have died this year. I don't know why my friend, my neighbor is sick, in pain, and dying. From my religious perspective, I cannot tell him that God has his reasons for sending this terrible fate, or that God must specially love or admire his bravery to test him this way. I can only tell my friend that the God I believe in did not send the disease and does not have a miraculous cure that he is withholding. But in a world in which we all possess immortal spirits in fragile bodies, the God I believe in gives strength and courage to those who unfairly and through no fault of their own suffer pain and the fear of death. I can help my friend remember that he is more than a crippled body, more than a man with a debilitating illness. He is a man with a loving family, with many friends, and with enough iron in his soul to remain a living person in the fullest sense until the very last day. The greatest, most important lesson for Mary to learn that day by her brother's grave was this. Even in Jesus' presence, I will face pain and suffering and loss and death. My task is to trust Jesus in every circumstance, so that even when I cannot cling to life any longer, even then, my trust, my hope, my faith remains in the one who promises life in spite of death, hope in spite of loss, joy in spite of pain. We are going to sing now a hymn that you know very well. And am I right that invocation is going to help lead us? It is a hymn that is dear to many of you, and I know that because you've told me so, but I want to call this to your attention. In the refrain of this hymn, you sing, "Leaning on the everlasting arms, safe and secure from all alarms." Notice, my friends, that it doesn't say that there are no alarms. It doesn't say that there is no difficulty, that there is no pain, that there is no death, for there are indeed. You know that well. But in Jesus' arms, we are safe. Our lives are protected in the everlasting arms of God. Shall we sing together?